Globalization is now stronger than it has ever been. There are all sorts of ways in which people are trying to assert their identity, and they're going to push back. And we may be at an initial phase of the pushbacks that could proceed. And so the question is, how do you devise an agenda that actually tries to get ahead of this?
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum. Our speakers today are Ernest May and Philip Zelikow. Ernest May, an authority on the history of international relations, is the Charles Warren Professor of American History at Harvard University. Educated at the University of California at Los Angeles, he became a professor of history, has been a professor of history since 1963. May has been Dean of Harvard College, as well as Chair of the Department of History. His many publications include Dealing with Dictators, Dilemmas of U.S. Diplomacy and Intelligence Analysis, 1948 to 1990, written with Philip Zelikow. He has been a consultant at various times to the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, and other government agencies. From 2003 to 2004, he served as senior advisor to the 9/11 Commission. Philip Zelikow, an authority on 20th century U.S. history and American foreign policy, has been the White Burkitt Miller Professor of History at the University of Virginia since 1998. Zelikow was educated at the University of Redlands, earned a law degree at the University of Houston, and his master's and PhD from the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He was a career Foreign Service officer at the State Department and on the White House National Security Council staff before leaving government service to join the Harvard University faculty in 1991. Since coming to Virginia in 1998, he served as director here at the Miller Center of Public Affairs and directed three bipartisan commissions, including the 9/11 Commission. His report for the 9/11 Commission, of course, has been widely hailed as one of the best, very best, commission reports to ever come out of a government commission. His most recent government service was as counselor to the Department of State, a deputy to Secretary Condoleezza Rice from 2005 to 2007. And he now serves on the board for the Global Development Program of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Please welcome Ernest May and Philip Zelikow.
Thank you very much. Grateful to all of you for coming. We have a fairly simple message that we want to convey this morning. The first is that there really is an urgent need, we think, for a broad framework into which the United States government can fit its specific choices about foreign policy, international relations, and economic policy to the extent that it intersects with those two. So that there is a framework for the specific choices that will be made by the leadership of the country from now forward. And it is our view that this has been lacking. It's not our view exclusively, because it has been expressed by the last several presidents, that since the end of the Cold War, since the fading of containment, there has been lacking any framework of this sort. And I tend to think of our foreign policy decisions over that period, since the end of the Cold War, remembering the experience of the United States in the Second World War, when there was great difficulty mobilizing the economy and the country for the war. One of the first people that Franklin Roosevelt called on to try to help organize it was the former president of General Motors, and William Knudsen, an engineer who'd started out as a mechanic. And Knudsen was asked to oversee war production from the whole U.S. economy. And he said to Roosevelt that he would take the job, and he said, and you just bring the problems to my shop and I'll cut them up. And I think that's the way we have approached foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. And some of these problems have been dealt with quite expertly. Some of them have been handled clumsily, but there's been absent a kind of intellectual framework into which to fit them. And as we will argue to you this morning, we think that the phrase, an open civilized world, can define such a framework. And let me, to move in that direction, say a little bit more about containment. Because containment was the framework, did serve as such a framework, from roughly the end of the 1940s, beginning of the 1950s, until the end of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s. It was a roomy framework. It accommodated many variations on the notion of containment, from the original definition in the Long Telegram and the anonymous foreign affairs articles of George Kennan in the mid-1940s, which was containment as simply putting political, economic, primarily political and economic obstacles in the way of the expansion of the Soviet Union and of communism in the world. It accommodated a larger idea of pushing back the boundaries of the communist world, roll back, which was characterized the approach of the late Truman administration and of the Reagan administration in its early years. And on the other side, détente, the idea of just accepting these lines between the two sides as fixed. But there was this policy, which was a lot more than a slogan, because what it did was in very shorthand way, to summarize a very widespread agreement about the definition of U.S. national interests and the axioms in a Baconian sense derived from history that would govern or would continually influence the choices that were made within that framework of calculation. There was an acceptance of the idea that you understood the world as somehow divided into two camps. On one side was totalitarianism. On the other side, something else which you could call liberalism or pluralism or democracy, but there were these, it was a binary choice in the world. And that the interest of the United States, the interest of Americans, was to resist the expansion of totalitarianism to maintain at least the pluralist and liberal or democratic world, however you wanted to describe it. That this was and this was then affected by these axioms, by these beliefs that were based on historical experience, which many people, for a period, most people, toward the end of the Cold War, most people still remembered that there was the idea of totalitarianism as defined in a vague way, actually, by Imperial Germany, but then more obviously later by Fascist Italy, by Nazi Germany, by Imperial Japan. And the lesson extracted from experience with those systems, that they were inherently expansionist and aggressive, and that if their expansionism and their aggressiveness was not in some way contained or reduced, that then there was a grave likelihood of war, of disorder that would injure the interests of Americans. As Harry Truman would put it, you let somebody go in and take part of Czechoslovakia, and the next thing you know, Japanese are bombing us in Pearl Harbor. So it's that sort of inference from history. And this combination of the definition of interests and the lessons that were derived from the past really did override thinking about all kinds of problems in all parts of the world for a period of decades, in the sense that the problems could be dealt with in very specific ways suited to their circumstances. But the first question asked about any problem that was being confronted was, what's the effect on the global balance between totalitarianism and the opposition? How does it bear on these beliefs about the way the world works? Now, we think of containment as having been one of a small set of what we label as capital P policies, not the lowercase p policy, which is the way in which you deal with a particular problem, is Knudsen in the shop cutting it up, but a capital P policy, which is this overriding set of definitions of interest and of the suppositions about the way the world works. And the United States, we think, has had historically a greater need for this kind of policy, for a capital P policy, than has been true of most other countries. Not that that such policies cannot be found elsewhere, but they're more needed here. In the first place, because of the peculiar structure of the American government, because we started as a confederacy of the states that had become newly independent. We're still a federal system in some ways, to a greater degree than is found in most other parts of the world. You actually do have different approaches to the world in different parts of the country. My state of Massachusetts has a policy, has a relationship with Venezuela, which is not at all like the relationship of the United States with Venezuela. We have our own pact with Venezuela. We've got an oil deal with them. There was a time when the state of Minnesota had its own policy toward Libya, which was treated as an enemy by the United States. So there is still some room for that. But there has been continuously this, what we call the separation of powers, but as Richard Neustadt argued, I think, compellingly, it's really in the Constitution, separate institutions that share powers. And we do have a president, an executive branch, and a Congress that are equally responsible for U.S. foreign policy. And we cannot have a consistent policy over any period of time unless they are in agreement. So that's a condition which makes it particularly desirable that we have these capital P policies. There is the general for the size of the country, the fragmentation, the variety of the population, the variety of interests that can have an influence on our foreign policies, and the porousness of the government. The extent to which the Congress and the executive branch can both be influenced by foreign governments, by foreign interests, by ethnic groups, and so on. All of this creates a special need in the United States for these capital P policies. We've had some. I won't dwell on others besides containment, but there are not very many. The early policy of no entangling alliances. Jefferson's policy, which was called Empire of Liberty, the idea that the United States would expand, but it would be an expanding commonwealth of equally sovereign states, not a metropolis with colonial interests. The Monroe Doctrine, the open door. International cooperation, first espoused by Woodrow Wilson unsuccessfully, then embodied in a lot of agreements at the end of the Second World War, Bretton Woods and various others, the UN Charter, and then containment. Basically, that's the list of the capital P policies. These policies have had a common pattern of development. It begins with the gradual agreement among the public, among these various elements, the states, the Congress, the executive branch, that there is a challenge, that one challenge overrides the others, subsumes many of the others, is the one that the United States must face. This is followed by a period of debate, sometimes very intense debate. For example, over no entangling alliances, everyone recognized that the great problem facing the new United States was whether or how it would be drawn into the global conflict between revolutionary Napoleonic France on one side and Britain on the other. And there were people who favored siding with Britain, people who favored siding with France, people who were in between. And the argumentation was quite violent. After all, a Federalist Congress, which was in favor of an association with Britain, passed the Alien Sedition Acts, one of which made it a crime to espouse the cause of France. And there was a narrow defeat for an amendment that would have imposed the death penalty for calling for an alliance with France. And you had the response in the Kentucky and Virginia resolves of a threat to break up the Union, of secession. So you had this debate, which then gradually you get to the last phase, which is the development of a consensus about which of these options or alternatives is preferable, which really best fits the common sense of what are the interests of the country and common understanding of what are these axioms that are derived from history. And that's been the pattern, the characteristic of all of these capital P policies have been that they have been, to use terms much abused, both realistic and idealistic, in the sense that it's become the policy, the capital P policy, has become supported by consensus among the public and the branches of government on a belief that it satisfies, it meets the interests of Americans in their communities, in their shops, wherever, their farms, and that it is at least not harmful to people elsewhere in the world and may even be for the benefit of people elsewhere. So it's both in that sense. Realistic and idealistic. Now, and it gets captured in a slogan like containment or open door, which is much more than a slogan because it is rich in this implication of what are the shared interests and what are the shared beliefs. Now, we think that the challenge now, like the challenges that produced the capital P policy in the past, is the clash in the world between globalization on one side and self-determination on the other. The flattening of the planet, the reduction of space and time, our all becoming neighbors with one another across the whole globe. This is happening on one side, and on the other, there is a sense of the vulnerability of communities, of institutions, belief systems, and their apprehensiveness about whether people can preserve their identities in face of this globalization. Just to make the point, this is not something that is without precedent. In the 19th century, there was an extraordinary wave of globalization. In some ways, in comparison with the past before it, movements of money, of goods, of people, of ideas that had been without precedent earlier. It generated this. It generated a lot of anxiety in populations the world over, communities, rural and urban, religious groups, ethnic groups, felt themselves threatened by this globalization of the 19th century. And elites felt themselves threatened, felt that this, not only was there a rise in anxiety among the populace, but also a sense at the elite levels that the structures that they liked, were familiar with, that suited them, were in danger. And you can see this in 1914 Europe. You look at 1914 Europe, and here are these forces, the nationalism that is tearing apart the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that threatens the Ottoman Empire, the preoccupation of the British with the Irish movement at the time, the possibility of a civil war in the British Isles. And what you get in 1914, the more we learn about how war came in 1914, the more it becomes clear that one of the things you had was a sense in the elites, especially in Germany and in Russia, that they were threatened. And the latest evidence that we have with regard to the Russian decision to go to war, which may have been the crucial decision, was that in the councils of the Tsar, his ministers were saying to him, if we don't go to war, we could have a revolution internally. And it, what happened in 1914, as you know, tore apart the world that had been built on the foundation of the globalization of the 19th century. And we are fearful that that might happen again. And I'm going to transfer to Philip.
So typically when we do this, Ernest begins with fear and I follow with relief. I'd like to, first of all, stay with the idea that the period we're in now is strikingly reminiscent to us of the period about 100 years ago, between the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century. There are also, my students are very preoccupied with analogies between the present moment and the Depression era, the early 1930s. And there are some interesting, there are some suggestive ideas that come out of that comparison. But the turn of the century period is very important. It's this period in which you see the relationship between globalization and self-determination, which we actually understand as being linked phenomena. That is, the notion that there's globalization, everyone gets. The notion that there's self-determination, that people are asserting their identities in a lot of different ways, whether they are devout believers in Islam who want to find ways of expressing that identity more politically, or the Scots who want their independent nation now, the assertion of identity in a world in which you're confronted. People understand that phenomenon. One of the points we're making is that these are actually linked phenomena, that the relationship between globalization and self-determination is like summer heat and thunderstorms. And we're seeing an era like that again, in which globalization is now stronger than it has ever been, with the integration of China and India into the world economy. And then there are all sorts of ways in which people are trying to assert their identity as they feel buffeted by global forces that they don't understand, they feel they can't control, they're worried their governments can't control, and they're going to push back because they're going to try to protect what's theirs, the things they value, the community, the identities they've been trying so hard to create. And we may be at an initial phase of the pushbacks that could proceed. And so the question is, how do you devise an agenda that actually tries to get ahead of this and manage this problem? One of the things that we were struck by in reflecting on the past is the writings of Henry Adams. Henry Adams, the fourth generation of American political leadership and thinkers, although Adams himself was not active really in public life. His father had been the minister to Great Britain in the Civil War era. His grandfather had been a president of the United States. His great-grandfather a president of the United States. Henry Adams himself was at the apex of Washington society. He was very close friends with John Hay. Their old home is now a hotel called the Hay Adams Hotel on Lafayette Square. He'd been a professor at Harvard, a writer on contemporary events, an author of American histories, and so on. He's a very interesting personality. He's an absolutely marvelous writer, also waspish, snobby, a bit misanthropic in different ways, but highly perceptive. He's looking at the end of the 19th century. He was fascinated by the way things were changing. He goes to all these exhibitions where people show off these gigantic halls crowded with the new machines. In Chicago in 1893, in Paris in 1900, and ponders just how things have changed in his lifetime, because he's been an attentive watcher. And he's struck when he goes to Paris in 1900, standing in front of this gigantic electrical dynamo, 40 feet high. Imagine the picture. Here's Henry Adams, this kind of elder, aging man. He's now 62 years old, balding, kind of dandified, standing literally inches away from this almost silently humming, whirring, gigantic, 40 feet high expression of power, the power of the modern age. And Adams really thought that this dynamo exhibited in this way, this was the monument of the modern age, showing off its supreme expression. And he asked himself, what are the forces this thing represents? This is a monument to what? And the answer he came up with, it's the forces are essentially anonymous. diffuse, disintegrative. It didn't really stand almost for anything. And then he thought back to what would have been a characteristic prideful monument of the traditional age of man. And the comparison he picked out was the magnificent cathedral in Chartres, which was the very height of medieval architecture and art, built in the 13th century. And so he actually writes an essay, which is in his autobiography of Henry Adams, called The Dynamo and the Virgin. Because after all, that cathedral, the Cathedral of Chartres, which actually was the subject of another book he wrote, just on its art and architecture, along with Mont Saint-Michel, that cathedral was actually a monument to the forces of its age, above all the force of faith. It really literally was a monument to the power of faith, above all faith in the Virgin, in the case of that particular cathedral. And this is an age, this 13th century, this is a monument to forces in which people think that they're creating a monument of ideals that will soon be shared by everyone, a monument to the unity of Christendom and to its aspirations. Those are the great forces that that monument expressed. And here are the forces that the dynamo expresses. And what's the trajectory you get from that? Troubled by this, he continues to write about kind of what's the narrative arc of where this is going. So he writes, for example, to a scientist friend of his in a letter I found that was written in 1905, that he thought the tempo of change, just by his own little chart of the way the forces were developing, would soon, quote, tip thought upside down, close quote. This is 1905. He warned, quote, law in that case would disappear as theory or a priori principle, and give place to force. Morality would become police. Explosives would reach cosmic violence. Disintegration would overcome integration. Close quote, 1905. Adams would live long enough so that it seemed his prophecy was becoming all too real. He died in 1918. He leaves behind two questions that he reflects on in his writings. The two questions that he really asks that come out of this parable are, first, what is it we are trying to achieve with these forces we have set in motion? Is there any hope to recreate some unifying ideal that can stand for what we might call civilization? What's the aim of all of this? Or is there no aim at all? And the second question is, can human beings actually master the forces that they have set in motion? You remember the Walt Disney movie Fantasia that has the little episode with the sorcerer's apprentice? For those of you who don't remember it or haven't seen it, it's basically a story in which Mickey Mouse is the sorcerer's apprentice. He learns some of the spells, but not very well. So he learns enough actually to turn broomsticks into servants. And then all sorts of broomsticks become more and more servants, and they multiply into the tens, hundreds, thousands, but he doesn't actually know the spell as to how to turn it off. Fortunately, the sorcerer comes back and, with a rather angry glance at Mickey, turns it off. But Adams is really asking the second question is, he sees all around him a sense that people are unleashing forces unknown for tens of thousands of years, but for the first time, humans can command forces that vastly multiply what humans or animals or wind or water could achieve. But can they actually master and control the forces they can now unleash and tap? I think those two questions still stand up today. And so as we talk about our idea for an open, civilized world, there are three points that we like to make about this, that follow on the ideas that Ernest developed. The first, global and local, global and local. Notice this interaction, globalization, self-determination. Part of the pushback of self-determination is the sense that global forces are coming at me that we're not managing. I have to build forts, I have to protect myself, I have to push back in various ways to defend my community or my values or our character. The notion of a global framework, which we support, is actually a global framework that's not designed to supplant local autonomy with some notion of a vast world government and uniform ideals. You can't get uniform ideals across 6 billion people. The notion instead is actually to create a global framework that nurtures healthy local autonomy and keeps the natural push that people have to define their communities from taking a toxic and fearful form. Actually, Brian Ballow, who's here today, has done a remarkable amount of work in American political development that is really quite subtle in noticing how government, sometimes visibly, sometimes invisibly, frames an environment in which people think they're making more or less free choices because government has created a healthy framework or healthy foundation in which they can do it constructively. That's now not just an American purpose, that's a global requirement. So the first thing to keep in mind is you have to balance global and local so that you actually nurture local expression and freedom through a healthy and stronger global framework. That's the iron. It's not a zero-sum game. It's actually a game in which you nurture one to actually enhance the other. Second main point, you have to come face to face with the principles. Adams's first question is, what is it we stand for? When we use the term open civilized world, we invite a discussion about ideals. When you use a word like civilized, which carries all kinds of baggage, you're saying, I want a conversation about what it is we're striving for. There's a wonderful line that Albert Schweitzer used. Albert Schweitzer, the man who started out as a Bach organist and who then became a doctor in darkest Africa. And here he's writing in 1923 after the Great War that seems to have wrecked everyone's hope for civilization. And some of the first lines in Schweitzer's writing on the war from Africa, he begins with the observation, quote, "We have drifted out of the stream of civilization because there was amongst us no real reflection upon what civilization is." Close quote. We need to invite that real reflection. And actually, in an essay Ernest and I have penned together, and I think copies of it will be available outside, we go through 5 different ideals that we think can be defended. They cut a little bit, things like mutual security, cooperative prosperity, again, the notion of an open world, not the fearful world of forts. The sense that we have to be stewards of the planet. And no, this is not because while I was sleeping, my wife was playing Al Gore recordings into my head. There's a whole body of work now on world history and ecological history that has simply noted that human beings are actually for the first time making a material ecological impact on the planet. We've had more of an impact. If you look at various measures of ecological quantities, variables, we've had more of an impact in the last 50 years than in the previous 50,000 put together. Now, forget climate change. I'm talking about things like availability of fresh water, availability of arable land, and several other indices you can look at. I think, by the way, you're hearing a lot about climate change now. I predict within the next few years, you'll hear a lot about fresh water. But this, just an illustration, but the final point I wanted to make about ideals is this doesn't mean, of course, that you have to talk about democracy or liberty under law, to borrow another phrase that's been favored lately in some think tank reports. The one, actually, the ideal that has to do with governance that we like so much is to talk about limited government. I think people sometimes forget that the primary concern of the founders was with tyranny and with the arbitrary exercise of governmental power, deeply influenced by their reading of the classics, by the way, in which this is kind of the traditional problem of classical political writers. Democracy to them was a means to an end, and one of several means to that end, by the way, because if you'll remember, the original framework for the United States actually was democratic in parts and not so democratic in other parts, in part because they thought too absolute a democracy would invite the very tyranny they were trying to prevent, because that was, of course, the most important goal. is to check tyranny. And so not only do you use some democracy here and there, you do some separation of powers over on the other side. The point is to keep in mind the goal was to limit the power of government. It turns out that that notion of limiting the power of government actually is quite profound, because governments that claim absolute power often have to carry with them all kinds of pathological stories about how they justify absolute power that inhibit their ability to participate constructively in any notion of a civilized world. They don't do well. Governments that claim absolute well tend not to be very tolerant about pluralism. They tend not to be governments that like interdependence, and so on and so forth, or believe in mutual security. It's all part of what's driving them internally. And the notion of limited government is one that strikes a profound and positive chord in Chinese culture, in Islamic culture, which always emphasized the notion of the just ruler subservient to the rule to the rules of God and to the law, and Islamic law, and so on. It actually has a universalist dimension, and it doesn't force you to be prescriptive about the particular mix of means by which you limit government and attain healthy and constructive participation in an open civilized world. The third point I want to make, first being global local, keep that balance in mind. Second being address principles, have that real reflection upon what civilization is that Schweitzer called for. And the third point is that an agenda of an open civilized world actually invites a really innovative policy agenda. Let me give you some illustrations of that. Five ideas, for example. The first, public order in weak states. So, well, isn't that what we're trying to do in Afghanistan? Yes. But it's not just an issue of the war on Islamist terrorism. The problem of public order in weak states also addresses the issue of the near civil war that's going on right now in Mexico. Right across our borders, thousands of people being killed in Mexico. You begin to see that actually the problem of public order in weak states involves and encompasses the way Islamist terrorists take advantage of those weaknesses in Somalia or in the southern Philippines or in Afghanistan, but actually picks up much wider phenomena of transnational crime and other problems that are being opened up. A second example of this. Think about the world economy. The way we thought about the world economy in the 20th century was dominated by issues of trade and exchange. And that's actually very much a national template. Nation states figuring out how to work the issues of trade and exchange. I'll argue in a truly fully globalized world, while you still have a trade and exchange agenda that's very important, the two biggest items on the agenda are globalized rules for investment and business operations. You see, instead of a fundamentally national construct in which a multinational corporation is an American company that has foreign branches, that's not what Siemens is. That's not what Microsoft is anymore. These are truly global firms. And the international capital market is actually a truly global capital market. You want tens of trillions of dollars, and a lot of those tens of trillions of dollars don't all fall in neat national boxes anymore, where you have a tightly controlled system of national capital movements. It's truly, since the 1970s and 1980s, it's been a deregulated capital market. It needs actually more regulation precisely to protect its stability for the free flow of those tens of trillions of dollars. We're discovering that now, that we actually hadn't worked on that framework, and therefore all kinds of crevices and holes opened up that are now causing cannons to careen around the deck in a storm-tossed sea. Similarly, for globalized business operations, for a firm like Microsoft, it's not so much work on, they care about trade and exchange, but it's more like for firms like this, they say, look at this, I have to confront at least 200 different rules on product safety standards, on competition policy, on intellectual property, and on 18 other regulatory subjects, and it's just very difficult to operate effectively as a globalized business in such a world. Now, if this sounds like a left-wing agenda for how to have global regulatory harmonization and increase regulation of businesses worldwide in order to protect consumers worldwide, I'm glad to have the left wing support, but I'll also note that this call for global regulatory harmonization has been echoed in print publications of the United States Chamber of Commerce. There's a reason for that. As they actually listen to those firms, they see the new shape of globalized commerce, which goes beyond just the issues of how national entities interact. A third example, how do you make globalization inclusive and sustainable, especially for the bottom billion in the world's poorest 50 countries? I serve on this board for the Gates Foundation right now, and they spend a lot of time thinking innovatively about how do you make globalization more inclusive. The altruism is important because an open, civilized world can't define itself by indifference to the fate of a billion people and uphold whatever set of ideals you think civilized stands for. But also, of course, you'll see that in this whole portrait of the world, you're living in a world now in which the pathologies of a large fraction of the world can infect the rest. The deforestation in desperate countries actually affects our environmental quality and safety. Another example, fourth example, is the control and management of ultra-hazardous technologies. Again, the sorcerer's apprentice ideas, we are creating forces, but if we don't figure out how to control these global forces, people will become frightened of them and they will react to that in ways you won't like. An easy example of this is nuclear energy. We actually need to use a lot more nuclear energy around the world. And I was very involved in government in the deal that allowed India to become a much greater participant both in the nuclear nonproliferation world and in the nuclear energy world, which would be a great thing to help India deal with its energy and environmental issues. But think about it. The more nuclear energy you have, the more danger it is that you're spreading this ultra-hazardous technology with all of those dangers. You have to have a system, therefore, a global framework that helps manage the most critically dangerous aspects of the nuclear fuel cycle on an international scale. Incidentally, the people who first built the atomic bomb foresaw this and had a fundamentally sound conceptual approach to deal with it in the Acheson-Lilienthal report of early 1946, a report that I believe was 60 years ahead of its time, but whose time actually has come now. It really repays rereading today. But my larger point is, whatever you think about the nuclear energy point, think about all the other areas in which we are now developing new ultra-hazardous technologies like genetic manipulation, the mastery of the human genome. Does anyone here think that the United States alone can manage and master the global use of these new techniques? You need a global framework somehow in order to tap the potential positively of this ultra-hazardous technology. And if you don't, people will react in other ways. Fifth and final example is the need in the energy and environment area to reduce our dependence on oil and dirty coal for a lot of reasons. Not just the climate change reasons, actually, but if for no other reason from a selfish American perspective, because to manage our current account deficit. Whatever you think we need to do for our political economy, you'll find we will not be able to do it unless the world begins to think we're going to get control of our current account deficit. And at least 40 to 50% of our current account problem now is coming from the importation of foreign oil. Just to give you there's no way we can spend the kind of money or do a lot of the things we want to do when we have to send out so many tens of billions of dollars for the importation of oil. There are a lot of ways in which, for example, that's a global management problem. The point is, again, on all these issues, it's a whole different agenda than what we have. Just on the issue, for example, of energy and environment, if we talked about cap and trade, you'll actually, if you dig into cap and trade a little while, you'll find out that America cannot do a domestic cap and trade system that actually works for global climate problems on its own. So you have to have a global cap and trade system. The global cap and trade system won't work, though, unless you have some system in which for offsetting reductions made in some places with rewards paid in other countries. The work on how to actually manage an international offset system, if you dig in a little further, you'll find is really quite primitive. In this area, as in so many areas, what I'm describing in a way is a whole new agenda. In some of these areas, even the policy options haven't been fleshed out yet. I think this is very exciting. We're actually entering a different era of world politics in which, if you frame this the right way, and don't just say, bring me the problem and I'll cut it up. If you actually come in with a template of an open, civilized world or something better, a whole new policy agenda opens up for how to think about the global frameworks that nurture and protect local autonomy, and it invites attention to a whole series of issues that haven't been given nearly the kind of attention they should be given now. What you have instead is a lot of attention on all sorts of different issues that people care about. And there's a cacophony of ideas. There are all kinds of different hobby horses in a fragmented government. I want to address global poverty. No, I want to address non-proliferation. Well, how about terrorism? What about the war in Iraq? All true. And our government will strike 100 notes, but there will be no melody. One of the things that is striking as I teach my classes on the Great Depression is I ask my students to go back and read newspapers from October 1932. And ask them, if you were a University of Virginia student in October 1932, how would you describe the most important issue of the world crisis? And if they just read the papers and pull it out of the headlines, the New York Times, the New Republic, the Herald Tribune, they say, oh, it's tariffs, it's government spending, it's this, I mean, there are all sorts, and I had, out of 90 papers, I had two people who mentioned the crisis in the Far East involving Japan and China. And then we step back from that today, and it seems perfectly clear to us that actually you are seeing a simultaneous systemic crisis in which both capitalism seemed to be failing in its promises. International security, collective security, seemed to be failing in its promises, and the failures seemed to occur at the same time. And after the dust settled, people by the early, by 33, 34, 35 looked at the world and said, ah, we're in a different kind of world now. We're in a world of every man for himself. We get that, and we will now adjust to living in that world. It's the combination of things that converge that's really striking about the present moment. You can't respond to that in the Bill Knudsen fashion. You need to respond to that with some kind of capital P policy. Ernest and I are actually really hopeful and confident that the United States has an extraordinary opportunity to develop such a policy at this historic moment. We really are at an interesting crossroads of world history. And out of this crisis, there is an enormous opportunity to define an agenda of this kind and rally really an extraordinary degree of potential support for it. So we're not despairing at all, but we think the times demand now folks who can look above the particular inboxes and begin to have a diagnosis of the systemic issues that are beginning to converge and then offer a capital P policy in response to it for an open, civilized world.
I would like to invite those who are in the room or those who are out of the room who would like to participate in the conversation to join me in the back of the room and to start the conversation, Drs. May and Zelikow. I'd like to read a recent quote from an article by Condoleezza Rice in Foreign Affairs and ask how this squares with your notion of globalization and self-determination being closely linked. Secretary Rice writes, although the United States' ability to influence strong states is limited, our ability to enhance the peaceful political and economic development of weak and poorly governed states can be considerable. We must be willing to use our power for this purpose, not only because it's necessary, but also because it is right. Too often, promoting democracy and promoting development are thought of as separate goals. In fact, it is increasingly clear that the practices and institutions of democracy are essential to the creation of sustained, broad-based economic development, and that market-driven development is essential to the consolidation of democracy. If our policy promotes democracy, is this in any ways inconsistent with your suggestion that self-determination must be privileged?
Yes. I think that, as you, I made clear in my remarks, Ernest and I are in favor of democracy. I just want to be very clear about that. Harvard and Virginia professors scorn democracy in remarkable public statement. No. It's just that, look, A, it's too prescriptive. And by cutting to the idea of limited government and cooperative prosperity, I think you actually get to the core goals and you invite people to tell me your story of how you will attain these goals, instead of we have a story as to how you will attain these goals. When I used to meet with the Egyptian ambassador and he used to complain about the way we were beating up on them about this or that thing, I wouldn't actually say, here's what I think you should do. I would step back and say, President Mubarak has been in power a long time. He's going to be leaving power soon. Allah will call him someday. What is the legacy he wants to leave to the people of Egypt? What is his vision for their future? How does he think that your country will evolve? And let me read a speech where President Mubarak has explained that. In other words, what's your story? I found that a much more interesting conversation to have. So you need, therefore, to define your goals in a way that invite them to tell you their story. With a sense that with goals that cut, but don't cut to the point of seeming unduly prescriptive and carrying a lot of baggage. And frankly, the other point too is that no abstract rhetorical statement by a US government official is a whit better or more credible than the policy program that is taken to exemplify it. So the democracy agenda has been discredited. And we can argue whether that's tragic, inevitable, unfortunate, whatever. I'm just simply, as a historian, saying that those rhetorical phrases have now been significantly discredited. So you need to find some different phrases that aren't associated with failed programs. And I'm actually rather modest about what America can achieve in certain respects about telling people the particular forms of government. I happen to believe that if they work on how to provide forms of government that limit power, provide for cooperative prosperity, do some of the other things we talked about, and have the kind of resilience that you want, I think they'll and promote pluralism and tolerance, I think that that then leads you in certain directions that will be constructive and healthy. But better for them to find that out for themselves.
Dr. Zelikow, my name is Larry Jacksina. I've been trained as a mediator, and so I've been toying with another definition of the word power. And based on what you've expressed, your ideas and your ideals, and what you see as those things the world needs, it seems to me that maybe I've hit on some points here, because a traditional view of power is the ability to control your circumstances, people around you, through the use of position or money. But it also seems to me that that's a way of perhaps a kind of cowardice, because you're exempting people, excluding people in the process. And I think even when Barack Obama made his acceptance speech, he touched on some of the same ideas, suggesting that he needs those people who voted against him as well as those who voted for him. So I've come up with the idea that perhaps power is the ability to face ideas and deal with ideas, understanding that perhaps you don't have the only means for solving problems, that you need others, and either their ideas or a combination will help solve the problems. And I'm wondering what you think of that.
May I jump in just? Richard Neustadt, the scholar, student of the American presidency, who was a mentor to both of us, wrote of presidents that, in his view, they had very little power. Their power, such as it was the power to persuade, was simply the ability to to reach people, to talk to them, and to get them to understand the kind of thing that Philip was talking about, getting the Egyptians to understand what was in their interest. And I think that's relevant to the point that you were making.
Just to add to that, I was really troubled during the 1990s when this expression arose, this is the unipolar moment, that we're now in a unipolar world where America sat at the apex. I never in my life used the word unipolar as an accurate description. I never shared that moment of hubris. I was around at the end of the Cold War and had a tertiary role in those events, and also in the victory in the first Gulf War. But a lot of the people that I knew, including myself, didn't come out of that feeling how strong we were. We thought we were important. We thought we were central. But we didn't think we were dominant. And further, we liked working in coalitions. We had built a number of coalitions, and they did really well. And of course, one of the hard parts about coalitions is if you work with other people and you share power with other people, you have to listen to other people. And sometimes they have good ideas and sometimes they don't. And you argue it out and you figure out a common course of action. Frankly, the period has passed in which the United States can rely on its brawn. We have to live by our wits. But we actually have a lot of wits. We're a pretty smart country. We're full of innovative, creative people. If we tap that and use energy, maneuver, look at what's possible. Look at Sarkozy in France. Look at what he's achieved just through sheer energy and ideas and action. It was a bantamweight fighting like a light heavy. Good for him. I think it's great. And imagine if the United States displayed 80% of that energy and agility and wit harnessed to its central position. Because believe me, if you look around the world, who do you think the world wants to put in our place? There is no alternative candidate. So what happens is when we push too hard, and there, frankly, it's because we are so powerful that we're so unpopular. But Lord Curzon once said more than 100 years ago, the old British imperialist and colonial secretary and viceroy, Curzon says, I do not spend 5 minutes wondering why Britain is unpopular. I simply look at the map and see what is red on it, and I know the answer. We don't have to worry about being popular, but we do have to worry about overreaching to the point where we no longer can play a constructive central role. Because what will happen, it's not so much that someone else will take our place, it's that the world will simply become more anarchic. And then that invites the kind of world that Ernest and I were warning about a few minutes ago.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all your remarks. My name is Bill Gray. In the idea of implementing a capital P policy, be it the one that you recommend or another that might come up, have you given some thoughts, and can you tell us what those thoughts are about the institutions, national or international, structure that might provide for the implementation of such a capital P policy?
Well, let me start the answer to a very complicated question. Certainly, one of the requirements of a capital P policy is that it is the product of some kind of consensus, and it has to have support within the United States across branches. It has to be an executive branch and legislative branch, and across both houses of Congress. It has to be bipartisan. Has to be more than regional. It has to have all of those qualities. And so the first requirement, I think, for someone or people who are trying to manage this is to work at just that, at trying to get cooperation across party lines and cooperation between the executive and the Congress, something that has rarely existed in recent time. So that's my initial answer. The second is simply to make the point that we have a structure of presidential management of international relations that goes back to the early days of the Cold War and revolves around the idea that the critical requirement is to harmonize the Department of State and the Department of Defense, military thinking and diplomatic thinking. And that certainly is something that in current circumstances, given the kind of agenda that Philip was laying out, it's a question whether those are the departments, the elements of our government that are central to thinking through these problems.
Ernest's point about national governance are totally right. In many ways, it's not a reorganizational problem. In many ways, it's actually we've lost the ability to do, we don't train people well for policy development, and we've lost a lot of the ability to do it. It's a qualitative problem. Government officials today do not function at anything like the level of competence they functioned in the 1940s and 1950s. It's just startling for someone who's read the staffing papers from all these eras. You'd think that that median IQ of officials in government went down 40 points. Since demographers have not observed this happening in the general American population, I don't think that's the case. But what's happened is that people back then were trained in hard schools of how to learn to do public policy administration and development, and nothing has ever taken that place. And so people come into these jobs actually not knowing how to do them. But the other quick point to make on international institutions is you'll notice neither of us ever mentioned the United Nations. It's not because we have any hostile prejudice towards the United Nations. It's that we're fundamentally agnostic about what institutions you use. The point is that form needs to follow function, not the other way around. The people who work in these matters today love nothing better than to talk about how to play around with the existing institutions, who should be on the UN Security Council. You can burn a whole year and half your political capital just working on that one problem alone if you decide to take it on. And it will not advance the agenda I talked about one millimeter. Instead, figure out what you want to do and then think about how to reform or recreate international institutions to do it better. So right now, for example, take the international investment issues. A year ago, I was talking about that, and I said, you've never heard of Mario Draghi and the Financial Stability Forum of the G7 finance ministers. But right now, they're the only people doing innovative work on a global framework for the international capital market, with dry things like Basel II and accounting requirements and so on that seem dusty, dull, except for the fact that the absence of them has now changed the face of the world. What this new institution will come up with, the G20 is going to meet next week. Bob Zoellick gave a terrific speech about 2 weeks ago as president of the World Bank, calling for what he called a new multilateralism, including, he thought, the creation of a new G14. And he even was courageous enough to specify who should be in it. There was very little notice of this. But that's an illustration of what I mean. Figure out what it is you want to do, and then design institutions that can do that, understanding that you're going to need to develop a global framework.
My name is Elise Marjolin-Guidoni, and I want to thank you for the level of thought that you have brought here, because it is a great joy. And I am part French, so I was very happy to hear about Chartres and about Sarkozy. And my first remark is that Chartres was a better institution because at least the Virgin Mary looked upon us with compassion, and also that the evil and destruction were contained in the idea that there was a devil out there, which it is more complicated to deal with now. The other thing I would like to bring in is, because it's part of my history as my father as a Frenchman was involved in it, is the Marshall Plan and the fact that there was this huge positive, incredible thinking and acting on that was exactly what had to be done and that could very well not have been done. And the history of the world would have been different. And what I think is that it could that level of thought could be possible because destruction had its way for years, and that in a way it was like after a storm when life starts again, and the problem we have now is to go faster than destruction. And does this way of thinking, and what do you make of the Marshall Plan, and what could be learned from it in these circumstances?
If you take a look at this article that we've written, we actually talk about the Marshall Plan at some length there, because it is a marvelous example of the implementation of this development of a consensus about the challenge and the way to meet it. And with the sense that in Marshall's speech, which launched the Marshall Plan, he was essentially saying, if you go back, it's a modest speech, but he says that the reconstruction of Europe, the reduction in poverty and disorder in Europe, the restoration of a European economy, is critical for Americans. It's in our interest as well as in the interest of Europe and the world. And then having developed that answer to the mixture of realism and idealism, he and his associates worked up an extraordinary bipartisan consensus across there were Republican majorities in both the Senate and the House, the Democratic president. They worked up a bipartisan accord on spending a lot of money that many people did not want to spend at the time for this purpose. And they worked enormously hardly to get support around the country. Marshall himself went out and talked to farmers groups, to local chambers of commerce. He even made one speech to a group of Cub Scouts to persuade them of the importance of these objectives. And people talk about a Marshall Plan for things, and they usually have in mind just spending a lot of money on something. But it was the manner of developing it and of ensuring the necessary consensus across government and across the country that's critical to making it an example for us.
You know, one of the reasons the Marshall, remember the story I told about asking the Egyptian, what's your story? One of the secrets for the Marshall Plan's success is the Americans didn't tell the Europeans how they were going to spend the money. They made the Europeans come up with a plan, and that was actually very hard for them to do. And then the Americans said, that makes sense, we'll fund that. And that created an extremely interesting dynamic that in some ways had a healthy effect beyond just the money itself.
Philip Zelikow and Ernest May's article on Open and Civilized World appears in the autumn 2008 issue of The American Interest. Copies will be available for distribution to our guests here in the room as you leave the room. Please join me in thanking Ernest May and Philip Zelikow.